Oh God, the door's closing. It feels like I'm being locked in a tomb.
Yeah, in a crypt, yeah. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, yeah, the theme is set.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
All right. So tell us who you are. Okay.
My name is Jack. I come from America originally. I studied linguistics in Scotland. And I've spent a very long time sort of in the mythological world of the Egyptians. That's sort of what this talk comes out of, is it comes out of the mythic world and the mythic consciousness of ancient Egypt, you know? So there's, you know, a part of what I've done has really involved human language, and going into what are the very technical aspects of language and how that functions. But the other side of all of this is sort of the world of art and the world of energy and of intention, and how these things mix with language. So looking at a picture symbol like hieroglyphics is sort of the natural place to find this medium.
What would you call your field?
My field? Oh God. I guess you could call it semiotics. If there was a word for it, you would call it semiotics. I know a lot of people have been influenced a lot by Peirce, Charles Sanders Peirce, who was the American founder of semiotics, and then there's Saussure, who's the French founder of semiotics. I would say that, you know, neither of them really get to the deeper, more spiritual or subtle layers of things. And this was something that really had a great impact on me from early in my life. So you know, Jungian archetypes and those sorts of things had a great impact on me as well. So semiotics would be the word for it, right? But it's not the way it would look, you know, if you went to any university department or something like that.
You're
right?
A semiotician.
Yes, a rogue semiotician. Yes. Yeah, right. If we have to come up with some fancy words.
On the run from Egyptologists.
Yeah, you know.
What do you plan on talking about in Orvo? What do you think is relevant to Orville?
Okay.
What brought you to that?
Well, let me see. Because this talk is actually only the first thing that I want to offer to Orville, actually, especially in this vein. You see, I've written a play, and it's a play about the creation of the first pyramid. And it's told from sort of a new perspective of that story. And I think this story is very important. Because many people don't know this story, and I think that Auroville has a connection to this country, to this very old country from 5,000 years ago, and I think that there are certain stories from that country that have gone untold, and especially this one, because, you know, the time in which the first pyramids were built was not a simple time. Things were not really going well, actually, for Egypt. There was actually a great deal of chaos and turmoil going on, and really very insane things were happening where the country was, you know, about to fall apart. And in the middle of this, you know, they invented the pyramid, right? So, you know, out of just a massive chaos, this beautiful thing comes that we now think of as this iconic, you know, ideal of civilization, you know, but everything was falling apart, you know? So this is a story that I really want to tell, and I felt, you know, coming here that Auroville was the place to do that. Auroville was the place to tell this story. So now I've written this play, and I'm looking for actors or people who might want to be involved in the play. The lead character is an older woman, and that's not, I think that many actresses of that age may not have an opportunity to be the lead. So that's something that I, you know, I'm looking for people who would be interested in being a part of this play. And as I'm moving through all of this work with the hieroglyphs, that's sort of informing the next step for me, which is this play. So, you know, if anyone was interested in that, I would really appreciate it if they would, you know, contact me. Should I give some contact information?
No, we'll throw that in the recording. Don't worry about it. Yeah, no one's going to sit there with a pen.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
At Yahoo. How do you spell Yahoo? Especially if you look for
Y-H-A. Yeah.
Is it a J or... It's a Yahoo.
Yeah.
But, okay, so... All right. How did you find yourself in the God? How do all right the semiotic World of Semiotics? Christ, I've never heard that word before.
Oh, yeah, so. That's an academic.
Is it an adjective?
It can be, yeah. Yeah,
it sounds like
it. It can be an adjective, you know? It can be, if you want it to be, yeah.
It's a verb, right?
Yeah, well, no, yeah.
I woke up semioticing this morning.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Sends a.
Not so much of a ring.
Yeah, sounds like a dirty.
It's a little bit. Okay. He died from semiotic. It's a shame.
Oh man,
it's a
horrible shame. Way to go.
Yeah, let's call it a suicide. It's because.
Anyway.
How did you find yourself kosher in the world?
Well, it was really linguistics. You know, that was what got me, and it was languages. I love languages. You know, this talk is at Language Lab for a reason. It's in that world. It's in the world of language. And, you know, hieroglyphs were sort of one of the first places that took me to language. And, you know, I went on and I learned Arabic as a child because I was so interested in these symbols. I wanted to be able to speak to people when I, you know, I was very, very convinced I was going to be an Egyptologist. You know, it's easy to get disillusioned as you go on when you look at, you know, the state of things. But as a child, I was very convinced I'm going to be an Egyptologist. This is what I'm going to do, you know. But later on, you know, you get older and you drift through things, and I wound up just doing linguistics. But now I'm sort of coming back to this landscape. So yeah, linguistics because it's word, it's language, it's communication, it's speaking, you know? The semiotic part of it is that the visual also communicates in the same way that language does. And this is something that we neglect a lot. You know, especially with the way that we're socialized to think about these things and socialized to interact. But, you know, the image also has a language. And you can see this when you read a work of art or you, you know, participate in, you know, a performance, or if you're an audience member, you see something that it communicates something in itself. So making that connection between the, you know, the more abstract or analytical world of the word and the world of the image is very, very important to me. And I think that's a kind of language that we need to be able to speak, really, to be, you know, full human beings in control of our capacities and all of these kinds of things, you know.
In such a world where we focus completely on the visual aspect of things, the physical realm of it, it's very interesting, you're right, that the visual part of language, of communication, is so heavily neglected.
Yeah.
It's such an obvious one of those things sitting right. That's a pun. Yeah, right in front of our eyes. Anyway, so what other languages or cultures have interested you as much as Egypt, or is Egypt the top dog?
Well, no. I mean, China is probably up there too. China, all the Chinese classics, all of the Confucian and the Taoist classics. Actually, first I did Taoism because I think a lot of Westerners, when they first come into it, Taoism resonates with them, especially if you have a mystical bent to your personality, Taoism will resonate. But then later on, I actually read the Confucian classics too, which it's completely different. It's very orthodox, you know, but there's like a hidden spiritual element in there. So that, and you know, the I Ching as a book has had a huge influence on me. So all of Chinese thought actually had a big impact on me. Oh God, I mean, this could take a long time. This could be a long conversation. I mean, West African culture, Nigerian, the Orishas, big impact on me. American Indian culture, you know, I grew up surrounded by that world. So when I got old enough that I started, you know, a few times going to the reservations and, you know, meeting people, encountering, you know, the people who lived there, that's a completely different world. You encounter their teachings as well, but it's hard to deny, I think, once you actually go to the reservations and meet these people and see them, you know, carrying on their traditions and their cultures in a new form, you know, and continuing to exist. This is something that most people in the country of America don't acknowledge at all. Yeah, but for whatever reason, in my early adventures, I got pulled into some of these places. You know, the Navajo Nation was a big. In my early teenage years, I went a couple of times to Navajo Nation. And had an opportunity to participate in the Puebloan culture as well. And that was really huge for me, because here was the first time that I'd seen, like, a real indigenous American civilization. And also, you know, so many lies were told about it that I just sort of thought that every, you know, I still, at that age, and I mean, many people, you know, continue in that country to think, oh, everyone just lives in wigwams or teepees or whatever, yeah. You know, and climbing, but then you're there and you're climbing the ladders and you're up there in the cliff dwellings, you know, and you're with, I didn't meet many Hopi, like descendants of the people, but I spent time with many Navajo, you know, who were involved actually in the work of, you know, preserving these ancient villages built into the cliffs. You know, just really, it's a completely different landscape. You can't imagine it. And I was just like a kid from Michigan. You know, I didn't have a concept of this. You know, but that had a huge impact on me because suddenly it was like, my God, here's a traditional American society it's real. It's a real civilization here that has continued. You know, right? But there have been so many lies told about it. You know, just like completely pasted over. That there were cities and towns and, you know, villages, all of these things throughout the Americas, you know? So that, you know, that also, growing up in that landscape, that had an impact on me. And yeah, I spent like, I learned Scottish Gaelic and spent 4 years in Scotland in the Celtic world, so actually longer in some ways. So the Celtic, you know, the Celtic tradition had a big influence on me too, but for the Celtic tradition, you have to be like a really good, you have to both be like, as someone who's willing to go and find some, like, very rare hidden books, and also, like, you know, be willing to jump off a cliff once or twice. You know, you can't, which is, so it's a tough skill set, you know, you don't find that many people who are gonna get through it.
Learning curve.
Yeah, just a bit, you know. So I realize it's a bit ridiculous, but you have to find, there's some like ancient hidden schools in Ireland that, you know, vanished like 500 years ago, but you can find the teachings of the Druids if you're serious about it, if you're really serious about going into it and doing a bit of detective work, like it's there, but you have to sift through it a bit. And certainly like for people, if you go to a Celtic country and live in a Celtic country, like among the people, it's there. Like you may be in church, right? And I've sung the Psalms in Gaelic in a church, which is a beautiful experience because it's not like singing Christian music, you know, it's very Celtic. You're singing it and you can hear the Celtic rhythms just pouring through it, you know? And so even though you're in church and you're with all the people, you know, and it's, you know, technically, it's like many times when a population is converted, you can see what's underneath, you know, and everyone gets it, you know, everyone gets it. So that was another world that had a big influence on me.
Yeah, you're right what you say. It's basically paving over the soil of the old culture, the landscape of the old world and the new world. I find that very much in India. The way they do it here is probably something I've never experienced, where it's just kind of this thin gloss of modernity, like, over all of this ancient stuff. You'll see, like, repainted temples and, like a temple is now like a visa office or something,
right,
like that.
Like, right, it's like, this right, is right.
Like, are you fooling it? No, they're not right. Fooling it. It's just like, right. It's just a building. Right. Before, it's a sacred thing still, I guess. But it's interesting. I have no... I've never, ever seen, and I've lived there my whole life, I've never, ever seen a Native American letter.
Letter. Right. Right. Okay, well, So you're from Chicago, right?
From New York.
You're from New York.
Florida,
from, okay,
Chicago.
You're from, okay, so you're from everywhere.
Yeah,
you're from everywhere. Right.
Everywhere,
okay.
Nowhere, yeah.
So New York, I was in New York recently. And you know, New York was once a country called Lenape Oking. You know, the country of the Lenape. And I had so much fun because I always, whenever I travel through the United States, I always try to remember what First Nation I'm actually in. I never pay attention to the white person's map. I always say, so what's the actual nation that I'm in? Mm. You know, so when I went to New York, I said, okay, I'm in the Lenape Hokan. And so I wanted, because it was very popular a few years ago to talk about the old settlements on Manhattan. You know, like, where were they not? So I was just looking at a map of Manhattan, and I noticed the northern tip of Manhattan was completely green. And so I was like, why is that? You know, why is the northern tip completely green? So I just sort of looked into it a bit, and I just sort of zoomed in on Google Maps, and I saw Native American caves listed right there. You know, it's just one of these, like, intuition things. So of course I'm like, well, I have to investigate, right? It turns out the reason why it's green is because that's the place where the biggest Lenape settlement on Manhattan was, and it's never been built over by white people. They've never dared to touch it. It's just stayed green. And no one really realizes this, but the tip of Manhattan is still forest. And it's still there. You can just go right in. You go into Inwood Hill Park, it's called, right? You go into Inwood, and you're right there, and there's Chaparral Rock, where the Dutch paid, like, you know, a tiny sum of money for the island, you know, under this old tulip tree or something. And you go up to the cliffs and you climb up, and there are just these beautiful, beautiful caves where the hermits of the tribe used to, I don't know, meditate in, or the shamans or whatever, but they're sort of crystalline and they reflect. This is right in Manhattan, you know, right? So right at the tip of Manhattan, you've got this sort of magically protected forest, the last protected place of the Lenape. You know, it's right there, you know, but no one sees this, you know. There's a sort of mist of enchantment that covers the whole thing over, you know. Yeah, but you were asking about Native American letters. So on that part of the world, the Mi'kmaq up in the north near Penobscot in Maine, they have a hieroglyphic writing system. White people have debated for ages about how they could have a hieroglyphic writing system. I think it was much more common among Algonquin people generally than, you know, we would usually acknowledge, you know, because there's been a lot of chauvinism. You know, William Penn was probably, like, he was the only person who ever approached, the only white person who ever approached those people with respect, right? He was the only one who ever said, I'm going to learn your language and actually sign a treaty. So there's been just so much cultural chauvinism with these people. So they have a hieroglyphic alphabet. And the Anishinaabe people, where I come from, have a hieroglyphic alphabet. It's, you know, linguists will call it proto-writing. You know, they won't call it actual writing. You know, it's the same sort of thing. It's this, you know, colonialist, you come in and you just change a few things, you know. So it's, you know. But the Anishinaabe will write on these very long birch bark scrolls. And these scrolls contain the sets of the Anishinaabe prophecies, which go back, you know, 700 years into the past, and also talk about the future of what we're facing now. And they describe the exact migration route that they took, because they originally came from the East Coast with everyone as well. So you know, these are nations with, you know, established...
In the West Coast?
East Coast. They came from the East Coast, and they were related to the Lenape and the Mi'kmaq. And then some prophets came to them and said, you have to move, go to the West. If you stay here, you'll be annihilated. And this was around 700 years ago that they started moving west. And then later on, you know, the English and the Dutch came and brought diseases with them, and people were annihilated, you know. So the prophets were right, you know. So yeah, there you go. Listen to the prophets, you know. That's the lesson there. Yeah, yeah. So they went over to the west, and sort of built their nation over there. And then, you know, the Hopi people have their tablets. They have some stone tablets that have their prophecies written on them. And they claim those tablets are 12,000 years old. Some scientists, they once went to test this, so they went and they took these tablets and they carbon dated them. And guess what? They were 12,000 years old, you know? So, yeah, look at that. Yeah, you can trust the native people. You can trust the people when they talk about... They know, you know? Yeah. So it's, again, you know, a bit of chauvinism there, you know, right? And then the biggest writing systems are probably, you know, the Mayan and the Aztec hieroglyphs, the Olmec hieroglyphs, and those go back like 4,000 years. And they had a big influence on like societies in Louisiana and in up the Mississippi Valley. There were a lot of cities built there with the earthen pyramids. So it was a lot of cities built in the Mississippi. And yeah, up through California and the West Coast as well, there was a different kind of culture. But that was the place where hieroglyphic writing was invented in Middle America. There's a sort of debate about whether they got it from the Chinese. And this is where it gets really interesting, is that there's a lot of evidence for people coming across the Pacific and settling in America and it having some sort of like sustained cultural impact. And this has been sort of a debate for about 50 years now, as usual. You know, the people who are in the academy don't really want to accept it, you know. There's some political problems with it. I mean, I, you know, personally, there are a lot of people who talk about how, oh, the Phoenicians settled America, you know, or like this sort of stuff. I don't really put much stock in like white people having come to America before like maybe like the Vikings or whatever, right? But Asians coming to America and Polynesians coming to America is, I think it's very plausible. But that's not one that either archaeologists or fringe theorists really like to talk about, you know, because again, these things are complicated, you know? But one of the other things is, you know, the Peruvians, who have a 5,000-year-old civilization in South America, one of the oldest civilizations in the world, they write with knotted ropes. And the thing about this, you know, the quipu, they're called. And the thing about this knotted rope writing technology is that it's also found in Hawaii, and it's also found in China. And it's, you know, right? So it's, huh. And it's mentioned in Chinese literature as well. As, you know, I remember, you know, first, if you read Lao Tzu and Confucius, they both mention that in the early times, men used to knot ropes instead of writing, you know? And then it gets traded across the islands, and it was all one continuum. You know, people were sailing across the islands, and then it shows up in Peru. You know, and in Peru, they only started about 1,000 years ago, out of 5,000 years of civilization riding with the knotted ropes, you know? So it's really, I mean, there are other things too, like certain kinds of pottery in Japan also being found in Ecuador, and there's an ocean current that leads right there, you know? So there's all of this stuff, you know, you can see it. It's not easy to, like, prove, you know? But it's right there, and it's sort of absurd as well. When you talk to the people and you hear their oral histories, they're like, oh yeah, we traded with people from the islands all the time. You know? So it's like, well, what do you think happened? You know? So that's another, we've rambled a bit, we've drifted around a bit, but I think the point is that the whole world has sort of always been connected, and one of the lies that we've told is that it's been a bunch of balkanized little nation states that were all always, you know, no one was in contact with anyone else, but actually, from the tip of America all the way to the tip of Europe and Africa, everyone actually was connected on one giant, you know, trade linkage for all like of history. Ever, yeah. Yeah, all of history. We've never actually been disconnected. We've always been in contact.
So that's interesting. It's very easy to find that out. I mean, just there's a million patterns that have connected all of the world, all human life. It's not just a bunch of random coincidences of ideas popping up at the same time. They're like, oh, they decided to build pyramids because they're fun, I guess. Right. You know, they're like, everyone just... Yeah, like, of course they started tying ropes as language. Like, that's obviously. So, what is your take on suddenly within this large history of traversing the waters and crossing ice bridges and being all over past the horizon, over mountains, through everything, that someone somewhere decided that the Earth was flat?
Oh, right. Right.
Like, what did that happen? And I don't mean now. I don't want to get into
right,
that.
Right. Right. Oh yeah, we won't.
I'm not talking about now. Yeah, I'm talking about way back. I'm not doing that.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Flat earthers can wait.
It's whatever. It's cool.
What was it? Was it Meek Mill? oh man. Well, so I think most tribes around the world, most peoples around the world, you know, when talking about the world, will talk about it as flat. And that this is not, it's not really like a scientific statement about the world. It's sort of like a metaphor. And I think it's a metaphor for like a sort of state of consciousness, for like a shamanic kind of consciousness where you understand, you know, an underworld, a central world where we live in, and a world of the heavens, you know? And you find pretty much everyone has this sort of tripartite division of the world that we live in. You know, there's above, there's below, and there's where we are now. And I think that's a natural way to look at the world in sort of an archetypal sense. And I don't think that, like, even with scientific information that may change how you consider, like, what body you happen to be on, we still think in the same terms of above, within, and below. Like, we still think, even now, even though we have this abstract idea that the Earth is round, we actually still think and orient ourselves in the same terms, you know? So I think it's an archetypal sort of idea that the world is flat. The idea that the world is round, I mean, I think that's been rediscovered a few times in history by a number of different civilizations. You know, I think Eratosthenes is the first. He's the first person I can think of who proved it. I mean, he proved it in Egypt, right? So that's where. But he was a Greek. He was not Egyptian. He was not, just for the record. But the Egyptians might have had that knowledge too. But so the idea of the world being round, though, you know, for that you need mathematics. It's not something that's readily apparent. And I also think that in terms of like the goal of human life, it doesn't actually matter, You know, if we're, I mean, which is not to say, don't do science. Like, please, scientists are wonderful. We need scientists, you know? But the sort of, you know, if I'm in a tribal society and my goal is to make sure that all the children are socialized as adults and everyone maintains the right social mores and no one, or mores, you know, whatever it's pronounced, you know, and no one is really violating a moral order, which is what I think the metaphor of above, within, and below is really about. You know, it's about coming to know ourselves and coming to know God or the divine, you know, and coming also in a community of beings to participate in that. So I guess that's sort of the answer, is that it's not essential to have like an abstract scientific idea of like, well, we're on this body here and it relates to this body here and this, you know, it takes a lot of time, and you've got to be the kind of person who really likes to write equations for, you know, to figure that out. So
what's X over Y in nuts?
Exactly, yeah. You know, you've got to have someone at least, you know, doing the laundry and cooking the food for you first before you can even begin. You
honey,
know?
Could you wash these knots? I've got to write. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, I've been for 50 years. You've been, you know.
I didn't write this knot. Who wrote this knot? Did you use the power washer? Wash this. It's delicate, honey. It's delicate.
It's even funny that I'm even talking to you now. I've been looking into cultural differences of words that don't exist in certain languages and that do in other languages. And I started with, I guess, I was doing this project on color and how there's such a vast range of colors that don't exist in other cultures. It's just ridiculous. We all see, it's not like a difference of eye where we've evolved with different eyes, like some cultures can see infrared. It's not like that. It's just simply the relevance of which colors need a name, which how certain cultures divide time, how it's all kind of this relative, your immediate environment determines on how you even perceive reality. It's very interesting. Do you have any experience with languages that don't have a written system?
Well, I mean, I learned Anishinaabemowin, which is, I learned a bit of Anishinaabemowin. I don't know if I could say a coherent sentence now, because it's a very complicated language, which is, that's an American Indian language, Anishinaabe. And, I mean, I said that they have their hieroglyphic system, right, but they don't have, It's largely orally. Most of it is orally transmitted. I guess technically, if we call that writing, which we could, then they do have a written system. The thing about color, it's always fascinated me as well. It's, you know, how blue and black are almost always the same in most cultures. All of this sort of stuff. There's something called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. It's the idea that your language colors the world you see. So your language, you know, directly affects how you perceive the world. And I think nowadays, I don't know, these things go into fashion, they go out of fashion with how people think about them. But the idea of, the idea that language does color your worldview to some sense, well, it has to, you know? It has to. It does. There's a sort of a structure, a way that things happen. One way that I heard someone once describe a way of thinking about it that's really stuck with me is that language is sort of like metaphysical garbage, right? You know, it's just sort of junk that clutters up your vision around you, you know? And so because there's slightly different styles, if you've got a little bit of different junk surrounding your metaphysical vision, you're gonna see in a bit of a different way. You know, so that's the best commentary on that, on the Sapir-Whorf thing I've ever heard, is it's metaphysical garbage.
Metaphysical junk.
That's what it is. It's just, you know, it's just junk.
It's just mind trash.
You know, and that's like, you know, like William Burroughs said, you know, like language is a virus from outer space. You know, right? That was his big, you know, right? Right? It's not, you know, because we're not, you know, when we're infants, when we're born, we don't have the words, right? We're socialized into that later on. Which is not to say that language, I think, like, directly affects your vision. You know, like, I don't think that if you have language, or if you speak language, you're not able to get to those states. But when you're in those states, there's no language there.
Well, what if? I mean, even thinking about 1984, right?
Right.
what is it? New speak.
Right.
How that how that edited the way people right. would even filter the world.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's ultimately what we're doing. We're filtering all of the stuff out. To focus on anything is to focus out a whole bunch of things.
Right.
So
right.
it's... hell, I'm even thinking about... I mean, you're American. You remember this... Crayola.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Crayola? Were you ever... You were fortunate enough to get the... The giant box? Had that ever happened to you? The giant box of crayons?
I think once or twice, yeah.
Once or twice. I was a sucker for those.
Oh, man. Wait, you're talking about where the names of the colors or whatever.
The names of the colors are on the crayons, right?
I remember this, yeah.
And I remember this thing is always stuck in my head, and I can't remember the color.
Hmm.
I can remember, you know, the you know where in the color scheme it is, but there was a color called macaroni and cheese. There was a color for macaroni and cheese, and for the life of me, I used it, but I can't recall what that is. I can't recall, like, if I were to see it, is that, you know, is the light on the walls like macaroni and cheese? I'm like, because I've had so many types of macaroni and cheese, and there's layers, and sometimes my aunt burns it, so I'm just like, is it brown? In my life, and I'm thinking about all these other colors, right. I mean, because it spans out from that. I mean, was it forest green? What the hell is the color of the forest? Right. You know, which forest, you know?
Right.
And then it scales out, just even the easy ones like blue, which of these colors is blue. There was a color in the box that was blue. It was just blue. And it makes me extremely curious how that particular blue got called blue. Which of these blues is closest to blue?
Right. Right.
And when I scale out to think of really anything, of just the word bright or the word the word language.
Right.
The sleep, the time, how you divide minutes, what's a minute depending on how you where you live. It drives me nuts. It brought me, I guess, to this. I don't know. I don't remember who she was that said it,
mm-hmm.
but she said this word that's resonated with me for a long time now. Mentalese.
Hmm.
It's the language we all speak before we translate it and convert it into language. Sometimes we do it in our minds, or we do it in our minds first. Or your conscious is speaking whatever your mother tongue is, or whatever language is most applicable, and whatever language you dream of. But before that, when it's that formless concept that makes perfect sense, it makes absolute sense. It has no need for explanation. And then to translate it and throw it into a language that you would understand, and let it go through your Byzantinian, you know, ear canal, and through all your preconceptions and your memories and your mental conversion to try to throw it back into your formless mentalese state. It's like refining chicken into chicken nuggets, kind of. You
know? I get you. Yeah, right. It is. Wow. I mean. Yeah, that's deep, man. That's deep. But that's actually what I'm after, is that land of pure sense. That's where you want to go. And it, you know, I think, like, the problem you're talking about has sort of been, it's been something that's possessed people for ages. You know, like, this is like Plato when he's talking about the world of forms. This is the same problem. You know, like, what's the pure essence of blue or green, or this ideal, this meaning, you know? These are archetypes. You know, there are realities that sort of pre-exist us, and we participate in them, in a certain sense, you know? And we're able to speak and to use them in these ways because of their existence, in that sense, you know? And then beyond them, of course, is like, you know, ultimate. There's reality beyond them as well, you know? And so they sort of exist as ways to communicate this reality. So we have this problem in our state, where we, like, our state as human beings, where we can't, you know, it is inherently ambiguous for us, you know, when we invoke green, because we're, you know, these are shadows on the walls of the cave, you know, we haven't come out, the first thing you have to do, you know, in that old metaphor is, you know, you get yourself out of the chains, and you turn around, and you look at the fire. So you see there's sense behind these shadows, right? But you're still not done yet. Then you have to go out of the cave and actually walk out and look at the sun, you know? And that's, then you're really, you know, you're blown wide open, you know? You're completely, completely lost it. And then you're still not done. You have to go back into the cave and get everyone else and try to get them out so they can see the sun, you know? So that's the old thing. That's the old drama. And I think we've been doing it well before, like, you know, Plato. You know, we've been doing it for forever. This has always been the thing. But certainly when we're in this world of communication and of, yeah, words and cultural concepts and understanding and all of this, you know, this is part and parcel of what we have to deal with, you know, what we're struggling with. So I mean, I have faith that even though we might not always in our words or in our language always be able to access that world, that, you know, that world exists, you know, regardless, and that we are able to participate in it. It's just we're not always going to be there. But you know, to me, that's what makes communication possible. Is that we all do have mental ease, and that mental ease is beyond any one of us. You know, it's always there. Otherwise, you know, these forms wouldn't have much meaning. But we're approaching the edge of what we can talk about. You know, just again, if anyone is interested in a play about the first pyramids, you know, contact me. You know, I'd love to hear from you. There's a talk tomorrow, 10 a.m. at Language Lab on the sacred meaning of hieroglyphs, how to understand hieroglyphs and their sacred underlying meanings. So please come along. Love to have you.